morning. Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later in the program, Bill Burke White is here with his monthly update on foreign policy and a commentary from Ron Bloomberg, because today is Tuesday. I'd like to welcome Marcela Diaz. She is the director of Somos un Pueblo Unido, and Elizabeth Bunker, who is a school counselor at the Cesar Chavez Elementary School. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. Now, we're here this morning to talk about the recent raids in Santa Fe by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is a branch of Homeland Security, in which 30 residents of Santa Fe were taken away from the city and deported. Marcela, who was taken away? Who were these people? Where were they from?
Most of the folks that we know of are originally from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and most of these folks live in blended families here in Santa Fe and have been living here for a number of years.
Blended families?
Blended families. A blended family is a family that has members that have papers and members that don't. And really, in reality, when we talk about undocumented immigrants in this country, about two-thirds of the undocumented, 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country live in blended families. And so because our immigration system is in such dire need of repair, folks are often not able to, and because basically it's broken and there aren't enough legal channels and there are so many backlogs, folks aren't able to adjust at the same rate, adjust status at the same rate as their family members, and so that's why we have blended families. And the majority of the folks that were taken away in Santa Fe belonged to mixed families.
Now, on what grounds were they taken away?
Well, according to what we have been told, these sweeps that took place in Santa Fe were a part of Operation Return to Sender, which started in May of 2006 and has deported approximately 13,000 immigrants from around the country. And what this what they're doing through this operation is going after folks who haven't shown up for immigration hearings, who basically have administrative charges against them. And so we're not talking, for the most part, criminals or folks that have criminal arrest warrants. These are folks that have orders of deportation because they either refused to present themselves when they were scheduled to be deported, or they just didn't go to an immigration hearing. And that clearly, I mean, is because folks have settled here and have family members here and have established roots in communities in the United States. And so about 30 folks were arrested and taken away. Many of them have already been deported, especially if they're from Mexico, but there are a number who are from Central America who have to go through a longer process and are awaiting deportation and are still in detention.
So of the people in Santa Fe that you know of, were any of them actual criminals who had anything besides immigration violations? I mean, are these people who'd robbed, you know, convenience stores or sold drugs or something like that?
We're not certain because we haven't heard any. We have heard reports of family members of many of the detained individuals and deported individuals, but none of them said that their family members had criminal charges pending in any way. I did read a report in the newspaper that said two, as of Wednesday night of that week, it was Monday to Friday operation, two did have criminal charges pending or arrest warrants, but the rest were here again, were taken away because of administrative charges. And so I think that's one of the big misconceptions, at least I've been reading recent letters to the editor, commentaries, that these were criminals. Well, in fact, one of the reasons why Homeland Security is not releasing their names is because these were administrative charges and not criminal charges.
Now, this was conducted over the period of Monday through Friday a couple of weeks ago, and as we've read in the paper and heard on KSFR, the Santa Fe police were not informed there was going to be a sweep. Is this standard?
Honestly, I don't know. When this occurred, we didn't even think to call the local police department at Somos. We started getting many phone calls on Monday saying, you know, immigration is here, what do we do? I mean, hundreds of phone calls over the course of the week, and we still get phone calls. We get at least 10 phone calls. Yesterday, we fielded about 10 phone calls and folks saying, are they still here? Are they coming back? What should we do? And we didn't think to call the police department at that point because we didn't know that they needed to be informed or that it was standard procedure to inform them. But according to our local police department as well as the sheriff, they would have liked to have been informed, in part for officer safety. I mean, it makes sense if folks are knocking on your door and they're not in a uniform and they are armed, that you are going to be very scared and that you're probably going to call the local police department. And so our local police and our local sheriff are saying that notification would have been a good thing just to make sure that there was no altercations or no misinformation between law enforcement agencies.
Now, we hear on the news that in New Bedford, a lot of children were left behind, despite No Child Left Behind. No. But a lot of children were left behind when there was a sweep there. What about here in Santa Fe?
Well, we know at least two cases in which the children were left without another parent to take care of them. And so they are being taken care of by other family members. And I'm sure that many of the others, most of the families had children. Most of the folks that were taken away did have children, but they may have left them with other spouses or with other parents.
Now, Elizabeth Bunker, you're a school counselor at Cesar Chavez Elementary. What was it like there for the young people?
Well, I think it almost felt as if we were hit by a disaster. The fear and the trauma that were involved were really intense. I think my strongest memory is talking to a fifth grade girl who listened to me as I promised her that we would not let anybody come into the school to take her away. And she looked at me and she said, well, what about my parents? And I said, I can't promise anything about your parents. And she looked at me and she said, so no matter where we are, we're not okay. And I had to agree, yes.
So what do you as counselor do? What does the atmosphere in the classrooms look like, and how do you do your job on days like that?
Well, those days I went basically from class to class and group to group. Unfortunately, the school was also taking standardized testing, which was pretty difficult for the children to concentrate on those very important tests. I just went from group to group and talked to kids and said, you know, basically we just have to get through the day. Leave it to your parents to take care of themselves. They know what they're doing. We talked about what to do at night if someone did come to the apartment or to the trailer. We talked about safety and getting off of the buses because a lot of the kids were afraid to come to school on the school buses. It was interesting because we didn't have very many kids who were taking the tests that actually missed those days. Their younger brothers and sisters, the ones that were not being tested, were kept at home. But I think it really spoke a lot about the actual loyalty of all of the parents, knowing after all the months of prep, the tests are important, and there they all were.
What about the non-immigrant children, the children of U.S. citizens? Did they understand what was going on as much as the other kids?
You know, Mary Charlotte, I was so busy talking to the immigrant kids that I really did not get a chance to talk to anybody else much that week. The whole week pretty much went to the terror of the sweeps and talking to parents about, you know, what do you do for nightmares? What do you do for children who can't stop crying? What do you do for anxiety attacks? And we had a lot of children that really had a hard time making it through the day. So obviously I didn't spend a lot of time with anybody else those days.
We're talking to Elizabeth Bunker from Cesar Chavez Elementary School and Marcela Diaz, the director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido. In the immigrant community, once word got out that something was happening, how did the community respond? What was the first you heard about it, and where did it go from there?
We heard about it from members who either dropped into our office or who called our office seeking information. Are they going to be here for a long time? What do we do? What are our rights?
But I mean, how did they know they were there? What was the first sign?
Well, they would get called by family members or by friends or by neighbors who said they're in our community, they're in our trailer park, they're in our apartment complex, they're driving around. Folks also heard reports from Spanish language media radio stations, a couple of radio stations saying, you know, that immigration officials have been spotted in our community. They're knocking on doors at local apartment complexes. In some cases, well, we heard eyewitness reports of immigration vans being parked at the exit of a local mobile home park. And so it really paralyzed the residents of that mobile home park. These sweeps, and we're not calling them raids because they don't call them raids, even though it was raid-like behavior. Supposedly, they're only going after folks with very specific folks that they're looking for who have these orders of deportation and arrest warrants for these administrative charges. And so they're going to their doors and knocking and looking for that person. And of course, if they would have photographs of the person on the arrest warrant. And if the family didn't know that person, or if that person hadn't been living there, which was the case in most of these arrests, they would proceed to, according to many of the witnesses and many of the folks that have reported to Somos, would just go into their house and start searching the house and asking everyone in the house for their immigration status, arresting them and taking them away. And so there were at least three apartment complexes, Mary Charlotte, where folks reported them going from door to door. And when you're going from door to door without an arrest warrant for a specific person at that door, that is a raid. So they're not calling them raids. They're saying they're going after specific people. But obviously the majority of the people that they ended up arresting and that are in deportation proceedings weren't on those arrest warrants, according to most recent reports. And so the community is obviously very savvy, and they speak to folks speak to each other and speak to us, and we get the information out as we confirm everything, of course, and really try to quell that panic in the community by letting people know, look, you have rights under the law.
And what
they
are
have
people's
the right
rights?
To be here. They have the right to be here and do this, obviously. We've never said that they don't have the right to be here. We question
namely
policy.
ICE.
ICE, right. Certainly. Federal law enforcement officials have the right to come into our community and do their job. We obviously question the policy and criticize the policy, especially on the eve of immigration reform. We think it's a waste of resources to go after families and very disruptive to our communities and punitive. We know they can be here, but we also know that we have the right to defend ourselves as a community. And so we put out flyers in the community. We use Spanish language media. We had members taking hundreds of flyers with information about civil rights to ESL classes, to churches, to schools, to businesses with information. You know, you have the right not to open the door. You have the right not to allow and give permission to immigration officials to enter your home. You have the right, just like anyone, not to divulge your country of origin and your immigration status. And so with this information, people were able to not be as panicked and be able to assert the few rights that they have. And so we saw a dramatic decrease in deportations over the course of the week.
Now, there were people who got their door knocked on multiple times, and as long as they didn't open, they weren't taken away. Is that how it works?
By Thursday morning, we had received many reports of folks who had their door knocked on at 6 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning. They knew, and the officials would be yelling out, policía, policía, which means police, and so that was a little confusing for folks, right? They didn't know if it was the local police or by immigration at first. Obviously, during the latter half of the week, people knew that it was immigration, and they decided to assert their right and not open their door. And we always say, you know, if they have search warrants, of course they can come in. And you have to make the decision as to whether or not you're going to allow them in. But again, many folks live in mixed families, so even if they have papers and legal status, other family members may not.
So if they don't have a search warrant, it's actually not legal for them to come in and search your apartment?
That's correct. That's correct. They can't enter by force unless you give them permission. And that brings me to another point, which is, you know, we were very concerned initially because we were hearing reports of what we consider civil rights violations, forcing their way in or asking permission. Can I come into your home? Can I ask you questions? Not getting permission, but still forcing their way in and arresting the folks that were inside. In one case, a woman who was legally here, who is legally here, she has temporary protective status, and she's from El Salvador. She had family members in her home that were not documented. They forced their way in and arrested two of her family members and then asked her, or she says that they intimidated her into signing a document that said she had given them permission. And she said, I didn't give you permission. And they reminded her, even though this isn't true, that she could be arrested for harboring undocumented immigrants in her home. And she said, I'm not harboring undocumented immigrants in my home. These are my family members who live with me. And she ended up signing that document. And we heard many other reports of similar situations. We also heard reports of one report of a U.S. citizen gentleman who was taken away because he couldn't find his U.S. birth certificate soon enough. We also heard of a 19-year-old woman who works at a local cafeteria and who worked at a local cafeteria and who attends the community college, who went to visit her boyfriend, and it so happened that they came looking for a friend of her boyfriend, and when they were there, they arrested both this woman and her boyfriend, and now they're gone. And so she's still in detention, and her family is very concerned about her and what the status is, and they're not having any luck communicating with detention officials or with her. And so that's another issue. Once folks are detained and put into detention, it's really hard for family members to get in touch with them, to talk to them, to visit them. And that's very concerning as well. So there are a host of issues here, the civil rights violations, the detention issues, and of course, as Elizabeth has already mentioned, the fear and the panic and the kind of the kind of panic that runs through the community, that doesn't go away. The fact that we're still getting calls, and that supposedly they're not here anymore, the fact that we're still getting calls from folks saying, are they going to be around? Is it okay to go back to work? I mean, the fact that we're still getting those calls as of this week really shows the fear and panic. It wasn't just disruptive to the schools, it was really disruptive to business as well. Many local businesses either closed down or really had to figure out how to staff their businesses during that week. People refused to go to work because of the fear, and they refused to go to school or send their kids to school, and they clearly, you know, refused to do normal everyday activities like either going to their ESL classes, going to the grocery store. So when we're talking about immigrant families who are only here to work, who are a part of our community, and who have established roots here, and who are contributing to our community, and who really are a part of Santa Fe, living under that kind of fear, I think it's not really humane. I mean, this is a crisis in our community, and you really have to think about what kind of message we're sending as a country. This really is, and this is just obviously isn't happening in Santa Fe. This is happening everywhere. You mentioned
Massachusetts.
This is really, I think, a stain, and they're doing this to a defenseless community. But folks are standing up, and our mayor was one of them, and Councillor Miguel Chavez was another, and the superintendent, and they are one of hundreds of leaders in the community and municipal elected officials, as well as congressional members, who are really questioning the way these sweeps and these raids are being conducted in this country.
Another issue is simply food. You, Elizabeth Bunker, have a food bank at the school. Did people need more food during that week?
Well, we do have a food bank, and it's for any needy family. Obviously, we don't say that this is an immigrant food bank, but it was interesting because that week the food was gone by the middle of the week. Parents were afraid to go shopping, and the kids were coming in and asking for much more food. And they continue to try to get food now, thinking we better keep some in advance. And kids have been taking more food than usual. We're always looking for food, and right now we don't have a lot. But yeah, the kids even are afraid of not having enough food. Basic needs like washing. Moms came to me and said, I don't mind washing by hand, but with 15 of us staying in the apartment, there's no place to hang the clothes. Because a lot of people are going together for sort of safety in numbers or comfort, or maybe there's the feeling that one of the trailer parks is safer than another, or perhaps one of the apartment buildings is less likely to be hit.
There, I heard on the news that this is now going to be a regular occurrence because an ICE office has been set up in Albuquerque. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that they might start instituting this particular operation where they go to communities and spend a week there going after these arrest warrants, but obviously sweeping other community members as well. And we know that they have, obviously, the authority to come into Santa Fe whenever they want. And so I think that is why we still continue to get phone calls at Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Are they going to be here? They said they can come back whenever they want. And so I think that the community is a little better prepared now and has the information, and we're going to continue to give that information. We've been proactive about our civil rights work, really, for the last 10 years. We've been doing workshops throughout communities, throughout New Mexico, really, and really preparing folks for any kind of exchange that they may have with immigration officials. And I mean, and again, we're not telling folks that. I mean, we're basically telling folks what their rights are under the law. So we're not telling them to do anything illegal, obviously. We're just saying these are your rights, and you get to decide in any given moment when you want to assert them, and protect your family from deportation and from separation. But that brings me to another point, which is we not only got phone calls from our members and from people in the immigrant community, we got many phone calls from service providers, teachers, counselors, social workers, healthcare providers, and really wanting to know what kind of information they could give to their clients or the folks in their schools.
Or their students.
Their students, yeah. And so what we realize is we need to be more proactive with that group of people as well, because they are the ones who helped us distribute information throughout the city on how folks could protect their rights. So we are going to be hosting a workshop from 4 to 6 at the B.F. Young building on Wednesday, which is tomorrow, just for healthcare providers, social workers, teachers, counselors, whoever wants to come, and let them know how they can help families assert their rights. And we're also going to be having an immigration attorney on hand to kind of walk us through the process of what happens once people are arrested and detained, because there is massive confusion about that. You know, are they being held in Albuquerque? Are they being held in El Paso? How long will they be held? Can we see them? And so we want service providers to really understand the process so that they can help their clients or their students' families go through that process a little bit more prepared.
What's the phone number if people want to find out more information?
They can call us at Somos at 424-7832.
And Elizabeth, right before we go, do you find yourself also in the position of having to counsel teachers as well as other students?
Well, we have a lot of teachers who've been in the situation for a long time of having immigrant kids. But yes, how do you deal with an entire classroom who's crying? How do you deal with children who are too afraid to go to the bathroom by themselves? How do you deal with children that don't want to go to recess because they're afraid they will be snatched away? And this is all new to us. We've never been hit this hard, and we've never dealt with this many terrified children and parents as well.
And I really think that what this does is it really underscores the need for comprehensive immigration reform. Obviously, you know, immigration officials have the right to enforce the law that's there. But we criticize the policy of doing this in mass right before Congress really sort of sits down to hammer out a viable, enforceable immigration reform. But we need to fashion better policies that respect, obviously, the human rights, the civil rights of anyone living in our country, regardless of immigration status, that legalizes the 12 million undocumented immigrants that are here, and that provides sufficient avenues in the future for folks to come here if they have jobs available to them legally and bring their families legally to this country so that we don't have to deal with this issue. And we thought that a bill was going to be dropped in the Senate this week, but it turns out that it's not, that it's going to take a few more weeks for the Senate to hammer out a bill that they think that they can start with in Congress. And so we really recommend, if people want to help, to start engaging in that debate as well. On the national level. And we really have to work on our local congressional members to really let them know there are certain things that we are really needing in our community when it comes to immigration reform.
Marcela Diaz is director of Somos un Pueblo Unido. Elizabeth Bunker is school counselor at Cesar Chavez Elementary School. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now and hear from Ron Bloomberg, and Bill Burgwhite will be with us in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. It's sadistic, it's evil, fiendish is not too strong a word. Somewhere on this planet, I don't know where, but there lurks a sinister, diabolic mind. It's the mind that came up with the plan to wrap nearly everything we buy today in hermetically sealed plastic packaging. Could be a children's toy, an electronic item, kitchen utensils, batteries, CDs, even sliced luncheon meats. Trying to get the item out of the package can be one of the great challenges in life. I bought my granddaughter a little portable Walkman-type radio. She couldn't wait to put the headphones on and turn it on. She's 9 now. I figure by the time she's 11, I should actually be able to open the hermetically sealed plastic package. Grandpa, open it. Oh, okay, let me just pull back the plastic covering here. Half an hour later and 3 fingernails gone, it doesn't seem to want to separate from the cardboard. Not to worry, I'll just get the new pair of scissors I bought and cut the top off. Brilliant, except the scissors are in a hermetically sealed plastic package. Grandpa, come on, I want to put the headphones on. Okay, plan C, a knife, a sharp, thin one, to try and wedge it in between the plastic and the cardboard and lift it off. Okay, now moving along to plan D. Surgery is needed. Stand back a little, honey, while I slice the top of the hermetically sealed plastic package. There we go. Oops. Honey, we'll open it later. Why don't you watch a little TV while Grandpa picks his thumb up off the floor? And I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
KSFR's Ron Bloomberg can be heard each Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, Thursdays after the news at noon, and just before the 10 o'clock hour after Bob Edwards on Saturday morning.
KSFR programming is underwritten by the historic Santa Fe Southern Railway, who say, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." You're invited to celebrate the wearing of the green aboard the Santa Fe Southern Railway on St. Patrick's Day, Saturday, March 17th, 6 to 8 p.m. You can watch the sunset over the beautiful New Mexico High Desert while enjoying a bit of the Irish, and that's no blarney. Reservations and more information at 989-8600 or online at thetraininsantafe.com. KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, also a supporter of the Santa Fe Poet Laureate program. Here's a poem by Laureate Arthur Z.
Juniper fires. Juniper fires burn in the crisp night. I am inebriated on juniper smoke, and as my mind clears, I see a white crane standing one-legged in the snow, and see clearly the rocks and shaggy pines, the winter moon and creek.
I'd like now to welcome William Burgwhite. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us on the second Tuesday of every month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Bill.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
And you were here a few weeks ago talking about Iran and Iraq, but one subject we did not yet get to is North Korea. There are actually some marginally hopeful signs right now about our relationship with North Korea. Tell us about that.
Well, I know I usually have to come to you with sort of bad news, telling you all of the horrible things happening in the world. There's actually some good news with respect to North Korea, but perhaps it would be useful to start for a minute and remind our audience what is going on in North Korea.
Yes.
North Korea is, of course, sort of the last of the true kind of Stalinist dictatorships in the world. It is run by a despot named Kim Jong-il, whose father was the former head of North Korea, and he's a little bit crazy. Apparently, he likes to watch Donald Duck cartoons, and you know is fond of starving his people to death. And like most despots in similar situations, decided that the best thing to do would be to develop nuclear weapons so that you could have your own ability to sort of stay in power forever. Well, toward the end of the Clinton administration, we engaged in a series of negotiations with North Korea and reached a deal with North Korea that basically they would suspend their nuclear program in exchange for us giving them 500 tons of fuel oil a year. They're very poor, obviously, and have very little energy resources. So that deal got made, and then the deal kind of collapsed after President Clinton left office. And the Bush administration took a very different tack toward North Korea, which was to say no negotiation, no engagement, and just sort of ignore North Korea. And North Korea used that as an opportunity to further develop its nuclear program, last year to test a nuclear weapon, and also to develop its intercontinental ballistic missile capability such that it could launch a missile at perhaps Japan or Alaska or potentially eventually even the U.S. mainland. And over the last sort of year and a half, there have been some efforts to begin renegotiating with North Korea. And in fact, about a year ago, we finally reached a kind of tentative agreement with North Korea on the nuclear program, and John Bolton, who you will recall was the former Undersecretary of State and then the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, didn't like the deal and scuttled it by effectively seizing the bank accounts of the North Korean dictator that were held in the Cayman Islands, apparently, and the deal collapsed. Well, in the middle of February, negotiations picked up again, and actually a deal was reached, and now it seems that with John Bolton out of the picture, the deal might actually hold. And it's effectively the same deal that Clinton reached back in 1998, I guess. The only difference is, of course, now the North Koreans have actually built nuclear weapons, whereas back then they hadn't. But they've agreed to shut down their nuclear plant in exchange for two things from us. One is, again, a guarantee of fuel oil, and secondly, our willingness to begin a process that could eventually lead to the opening of diplomatic relations with North Korea. In fact, today, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in North Korea beginning the process of sort of opening up North Korea to nuclear inspections again. And in a funny story that I actually read this morning, if any of your audience is interested in visiting North Korea, the North Koreans have now announced that they will allow U.S. tourists to visit for 3 days in May. So it appears that there's a bit of a thaw with the North Koreans, and we could certainly talk about some of the other factors that lie behind that.
Wow, 3 days in May. I wonder if their hotels are already all booked up.
I'm guessing there's still space available.
Now, Bill, the way you talk about the leader of North Korea as a slightly crazy person, when you make negotiations with a slightly crazy person, how do you have enforcement mechanisms so that everybody is holding up their end of the bargain?
Well, there's a couple things. That first of all, we're not actually negotiating face to face with Kim Jong-il. He has nuclear negotiators and diplomats who do that, who are slightly less crazy. Of course, very few of us have ever met Kim Jong-il. Madeleine Albright had the chance to do so when she was in North Korea a few years back. So we have sort of these kind of sketchy reports about his behavior, but certainly this is not a rational leader. Rational leaders don't starve their people to death and sit around watching Daffy Duck cartoons. So there's always the danger that he'll change his mind, and he's done that in the past. And one of John Bolton's criticisms that is actually potentially a valid criticism is the North Koreans like to make these deals and back out of them. Why should we trust them this time? And you're very right that that's a concern. But there's a couple of structural changes that have gone on that I think are very important. The two countries that have been the strongest supporter for North Korea are China and Russia. China, as it has become more powerful and tried to emerge as a global player, has realized that in order to be seen as a sort of viable part of international diplomacy, it has to sort of play the game according to the rules that are out there in terms of, you know, how you negotiate with states, and it has realized that having a nuclear-armed North Korea is a bad thing for China for two reasons. One is that it makes China look bad, that it has hasn't been able to sort of quell North Korean aspirations for nuclear energy, and because the Japanese and others could decide that if North Korea is going to be a nuclear state, they need to be as well, and that's bad for China. So China has cracked down on North Korea. It's increased the price of oil flowing into North Korea. It's cracked down on allowing this sort of banking and trade that was going on along the kind of border between China and North Korea, and that's put a lot of new pressure on the North Korean regime. And similarly, as Russia has become more prosperous and has had this sort of oil boom, it's realized that it can make a lot more money selling its oil at full price elsewhere rather than giving it away to the North Koreans. And so the North Korean regime is in a real bind, and I think that it's partly this Chinese and Russian willingness to put pressure on North Korea that means it's much more likely this deal will hold up than any of the past deals with the North Koreans that have been negotiated.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. The Bush administration policy has been basically to ignore North Korea. What happened? I mean, are there new people who are saying we got to do something?
I think there's a couple pieces to it. First of all, Condoleezza Rice's State Department now has power in Washington and can take the lead on this. So what was happening before was that Bolton, who was, of course, in the State Department and the Defense Department, were trying to prevent any deal with North Korea, because a deal with North Korea that worked would mean it would make it look like you could negotiate a deal with Iran that could work, and that was sort of the thing they didn't want. So there are some new voices in Washington. The other thing I think that's happened is that the Bush administration has looked at the failure of its Iraq policy, and I think most people in the administration will say, hey, things haven't worked the way we expected them to, and want to have both a quick victory in the sense of being able to say, hey, we have a deal with North Korea, we've made America safer, and not to have to commit resources to North Korea. We have to move troops out of the demilitarized zone because we don't have enough troops to even keep in Iraq at the moment. And so we have to reduce the level of tension with North Korea. And I think the recognition that a deal on the nuclear issue would free us up to worry more about areas that right now appear more problematic to us.
When you say that they didn't want a deal with Iran that would work, that's rather disturbing. What do you mean?
There are a group of very strong neoconservatives in the White House and surrounding the White House and the Defense Department whose vision of the Middle East was one of recreating and rebuilding a democratic Middle East, starting with Iraq and spreading outward from there. And part of the logic of that, or part of the justification for that, of course, is Iranian nuclear ambitions. And so if you have a deal with North Korea, it says, hey, deals are possible that can diplomatically solve the situation where countries decide they want to acquire nuclear weapons, and that would undermine their claims that the only way to deal with Iran is military force or pressure that eventually overthrows the government. I think it's pretty clear from John Bolton's writings and speeches that that was his vision of this, and he didn't want to deal with the North Koreans precisely because it would make it sort of clear to everyone that you can negotiate deals with unpleasant regimes that have nuclear ambitions, and then you wouldn't be able to force change politically in Iran, which is what they want to do next.
And so, what does that tell us about Iran right now? I mean, does the pending deal with North Korea make a deal with Iran more possible?
I think it absolutely does. If we can get a deal with North Korea that works, it suddenly provides, I'm using the word ammunition, but that's not the right word because it gives the wrong sense. But it gives the people within the U.S. administration and those critics outside it who say, "Hey, a deal is possible with Iran," new arguments to make with those who are supporting a military action in Iran to be able to say, "Look, we can negotiate deals. We don't have to go to war, and we're all going to be better off if we use the soft touch of diplomacy rather than the hard military force." And so I think that we're starting to see people in Washington using the North Korean negotiations as leverage to try to shift administration policy with respect to Iran.
Let's go to Iran for a moment, because there's something that we didn't talk about last time, which I think is important to ask,
Which is, we know that Iran is doing uranium enrichment, but what is it really for? I mean, is it for making nuclear power in for Iranian people, or is it for vaporizing human beings through bombs? What's going on?
Well, you've asked the billion-dollar question that will in some ways probably determine whether we end up at war in Iran and how many U.S. and Iranian lives are lost in the process. The problem is, it's very, very hard to know. Even the CIA classified intelligence probably doesn't have an answer to that question. And here's why. In order to run a nuclear power plant, you need to have enriched uranium fuel. You basically start with uranium that you can mine in, you know, some mine somewhere. And that uranium is pretty much inert. It can't do any damage. You can't use it in an atomic bomb, nor can you use it in a nuclear power plant. And in order to use it in a nuclear power plant, you have to enrich that uranium to at least 3%. And we did talk last time a little bit about these centrifuges that the Iranians have. And the way you enrich uranium is you put it in a centrifuge and you spin it for a while. And it's a series of these centrifuges. And if you do it long enough, you can enrich uranium to 3%. If, however, you leave the uranium in the centrifuge for longer and have more centrifuges running, you can enrich the uranium up to, say, 90%. And by 90%, what we mean is the ratio of an enriched form of uranium, which has an extra molecule in it, or an extra atom in the molecule, versus less enriched uranium that doesn't have it. So if you spin it through these centrifuges long enough, you can get it up to, say, 90%, which is what you need to make an atomic weapon.
Now, that's a very, very big difference. As we've discussed on this program in the past during our nuclear series, enriched the isotope of enriched uranium for power plants and for bombs, it's a great deal of difference.
It's a great deal of difference, and
process.
It's a long time to sit in one of these centrifuges and get further enriched. But the technology is fundamentally the same, as I think some of your other guests have talked to you about.
Right.
So how do we know what Iran's trying to do? Well, it's very expensive to enrich uranium. And if your goal is simply to run a nuclear power plant, the cheapest way to do it is to buy your enriched uranium from some other country that has the technology to make enriched uranium, from the Russians, from the Europeans, etc. And unless you're running somewhere between 50 and 70 nuclear reactors for power, it doesn't make financial sense to develop your own capability to enrich uranium. The Iranians have 1.5 or maybe 2 nuclear reactors, so there is no economic reason for them to be enriching uranium. So there's 2 explanations that flow from that. The first is that they're trying to enrich uranium so that they have the ability to enrich it up to 90%, which you can't buy and make a nuclear bomb. The second explanation, which is where I come out, is that they want to show the world that they are capable of enriching uranium, that it's not so much about the actual ability to make it yourself rather than buy it, but it's about the ability to say to the Middle East and to the U.S. and to others, we are a great civilization, we have smart scientists, and we are capable of doing this. And that nobody really can tell, because it's sort of, you know, reaching into the brains of the Iranian leadership and saying, why are you doing this? But what we do know is what they're doing makes no financial sense. So it's either a covert program to make a bomb, or it's a sort of game trying to prove their abilities.
So that's a very expensive form of, for lack of a better word, posturing.
Yeah, it would be a very expensive form of posturing, but it wouldn't be an inexplicable form of posturing, because a large part of what Iranian diplomacy is about is this trying to assert itself as a great power in the region. And, you know, the U.S. and other countries spend a lot more money than that trying to assert power, and if the Iranians have decided that the best way to assert power is to show that you can enrich uranium, then it could be you could understand the decision, but it also opens up a kind of opportunity for the U.S. to reach a deal with Iran, which is that if you tell the Iranian government and make it clear to them that this is not in their financial interest, which they know, and they recognize that they've got a lot of economic problems, basically because they have an exploding population that all needs jobs, that that money could be much better spent elsewhere. So if there's a way to recognize the Iranian right to nuclear energy and to perhaps give them some access to international supplies of enriched uranium, they might decide that it's not in their best interest to waste a vast number of billions of dollars of oil revenue trying to learn how to enrich uranium.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. I wanted to move over to Sudan and the area of the International Criminal Court, which is one of your areas of expertise. What is happening in Sudan now? There have been some indictments for war crimes.
Yeah, so back in the in 2005, the UN Security Council referred the situation in Sudan to the International Criminal Court, right? So normally the International Criminal Court can only hear a case if the national government has signed up to the treaty, and Sudan hasn't done so. But the Security Council has the power to assign a case to the International Criminal Court, and it did that with respect to the situation in Darfur. And over the last year and a half, the International Criminal Court's been investigating the situation in Darfur, and that was a very difficult investigation to conduct because the International Criminal Court wasn't able to get on the ground in Sudan, so it had to basically interview people in neighboring countries to try to find out what was going on. And finally, last week, the International Criminal Court issued two summonses, which is slightly different than an arrest warrant, but they basically said, we suspect these two people of crimes, and we're demanding that they come and appear before the court to face questions and then eventually have an arrest warrant issued. But the indictments that were handed down were for two people. The first of these people is a guy named Ahmad Haroon, and he is one of the leaders of the Janjaweed militia in Sudan, and he was the former Minister of State for the Interior of the government of Sudan. And he was effectively in charge of the Sudanese government's policy toward Darfur. And there are pretty good reports that he would fly out to the Darfur region of Sudan with vast boxes of cash and hand the cash over to the militia members. And effectively, he would show up in a town, hand over cash, and the next day the town would be attacked by the militia. The second person who was indicted is a guy named Ali Kashyab, who was the leader of the Janjaweed militia in Sudan. And so he was the kind of guy you've probably seen pictures of, these Janjaweed riding around in horses and jeeps coming into towns, stealing all of the property, raping the women and enslaving the children and killing the men. And so the International Criminal Court has now summoned those two people to come before the court.
And so, as you say, Sudan doesn't, because they're not a signatory to the ICC, even with this rule of the UN Security Council, they don't want to participate.
No, they don't want to participate at all. They have issued a number of government statements saying that they're not going to hand these two people over. And now there's a real test for the International Criminal Court. And the test goes like this. We have created an international court to prosecute the worst crimes in the world, but we have not given it the power to actually drop into Sudan and arrest people. So you're left with a court now that has made a threat to say, we're going to prosecute you, but has no way to carry that threat out. And one of two things will happen. Either the Sudanese government will comply, or perhaps with pressure from the Security Council, the Sudanese government will be forced to comply, or they will continue to flaunt the court. And if they flaunt the court, I think what we'll see is the fact that this court is an empty threat revealed to the world, and the court may lose its legitimacy and its power. Or if we can actually get the Sudanese government to comply, we might show the world that this court is serious and that if you commit these kinds of crimes, you're likely to find yourself sitting in The Hague facing prosecution.
The evidence against these two people, how strong is it?
Well, it's unusual evidence because the court has not been able to go into Sudan and dig through Sudanese government records or go into the refugee camps in Sudan and interview people. So most of the evidence is based on testimony of people who had somehow escaped from Sudan. So they have very good testimony to say, you know, that these people were seen doing this, that, and the other thing in Sudan. But they don't have a lot of documentary evidence, actual, you know, statements by government officials on paper, because they have no ability to access that material. So I think it's a pretty good case, but what it's not, if you look at it, it's not a case against the president of Sudan or the minister of security, who's probably the two sort of most responsible, and that's because they have no ability to go into Sudan and get the evidence that links those most senior government officials up with the policy. So they can only really go after the people who have shown their face in Darfur and been seen committing or funding these criminal activities. And that, again, reflects the problem you noted, Mary Charlotte, that the court has no cooperation from the Sudanese government.
So people who are in favor of the International Criminal Court must be taking actions to try to make these indictments happen and get these guys over to The Hague. How are they going about that?
Well, I think there's a bunch of us who are nervous at the moment, to say the least, because the court has put itself out on a limb here. There's a couple things going on. One is there's direct pressure on the Sudanese government to comply, and that pressure is coming from NGOs, from the states that most strongly support the International Criminal Court, such as, you know, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, etc.
But not the United States.
Not the United States directly, and it will be interesting to see. It's too early to know right now what level of support the U.S. will provide. We didn't veto the court getting this case at the Security Council, and there is some pressure on us to at least sort of help try to secure the apprehension of these individuals. But right now it's really at the level of bilateral diplomacy, Germany, the U.K. pushing on Sudan. If Sudan continues not to comply, the Security Council will get the case back. Effectively, the International Criminal Court will say to the Security Council, you referred this case to us, the Sudan isn't complying, help us out. At which point, the Security Council will have a bit of a showdown to see whether it's willing to impose sanctions or in some way authorize force against Sudan to apprehend these individuals. That's still a number of months away, but that, I think, will be the ultimate test of whether the court has strong enough backing to be a viable institution to stop these kinds of atrocities.
Bill Burke-White, the time has come. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
The pleasure was mine. I wish you and your listeners a good day.
And same to you. Bill Burke-White is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us now on the second Tuesday of every month from 8:30 to 9. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org, a marvelous website, and you can reach me by email at radiocafe@ksfr.org, or you can leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.